Linda? All right, I'm going to call the Public Safety Subcommittee of the Subcommittee to order. I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 5058, which was continued from yesterday. And today we were going to start out with Department of Administrative Services and have Linda take us through the walk on this budget. Linda, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. I believe you have our document in front of you. Starting on page 2, the 0305 governor's budget is 12.4% less in general fund and 12% in total funds less than the close of session budget for 0103. And total, it's 17.3% less than the budget through the fifth special session. Positions and FTE are down about a quarter. You would also note that this is lower than the, in general fund, it's lower than the 9901 actual levels. The next page is the budget by the fund type. General fund is certainly the large share of it at 85%. Federal funds are attached to the community programs section of the agency. They're Title 19 Medicaid funds. Other fund sources are trust funds, nutrition program funding, county detention, and grants and work programs, and they're about 5% of the budget. The next page would be highlights, starting with the governor's budget is a 17.3% decrease from the 0103 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. The 0103 changes include $9.4 million in general fund reduction, about 4.1%. From the close of session budget, and then just as an FYI, that number has risen to $12.2 million reduction in 0103 general fund through the March 2003 Senate Bill 5548 action. The reductions in this budget were achieved through eliminating 250 close custody beds, eliminating community services such as shelter care and counseling, eliminating emergency fund reserves for 50 close custody beds, refunding and using unexpected interest earnings from debt service, and finally by holding vacancies, holding position vacancies and delaying new hires. The next page, page 5, discusses what's left in the budget for 0305. There are 800 beds as listed here at McLaren Hillcrest and Rogue Valley. The Youth Accountability Camp in Tillamook has 50 beds. 125 transition work study program beds. There are still services to youth in the community, parole and probation staff, foster care, shelter and residential care, and counseling. And finally, there is a condensed middle management resulting from a recent 2003 reorganization. The next page shows the budget by program unit. This duplicates Ms. Baker's display from yesterday. There are two things I would point to. One is that organizationally, we've pulled debt service out to be a separate program unit this time, so you can see exactly how much it is. It's $10.6 million, about 4% of the budget. And the other thing I would point out is a dog that's not barking. There is no capital construction in this budget. Next page shows the budget by categories. The special payments on the left is $71 million. It's about 30% of the budget. And this funds the community programs. These are dollars to counties and to individuals. Services and supplies, about 13% of the budget. Personal services at 53% is the largest part, $124 million. On the next page, we begin the process of building the budget. The adopted budget for 0103 was $270 million total funds, of which $229 was general fund, were 1,380 positions. Through April, there was a reduction of $5.6 million in general fund, and that was in the March 2002 special session. Of that amount, $1.7 million was in one-time reduction, $3.9 million permanent reductions. Base budget adjustments, of course, included the roll-up of 0103 position actions, a base debt service adjustment, and a non-limited other funds reduction of $24 million. The non-limited other funds was put in 103 to accommodate a refinancing of all of the outstanding COPs. The next four pages cover the essential and policy packages that finally build to the final 0305 budget. Essential packages include Package 10, which is vacancy factors and non-PIX personal services. 20 is phased in and out programs as well as one-time, so that we phased in the one-time reductions that had been made in Special Session 2, phase out the permanent reductions also made in Special Session 2, and finally phased in biennializing the 0103 population forecast for close custody beds and for the foster care workload increase. Inflation totaled $5.3 million general fund, $6.8 million total funds. It was 3.5% for most line items, higher for attorney general charges. There were two exceptions, one for extraordinary pharmaceutical costs and one for property insurance deductibles. On the following page, we start with Package 40, mandated caseload. It was a reduction of about $500,000 general fund and total funds, and it reflects the April 2002 Office of Economic Analysis DAS forecast. The average monthly population was 40.83 less than the average in 0103. Parole staff reduces by one position as a result of the lower population forecast. Foster care costs were expected to increase, and that partially offsets the reductions in the close custody forecast. Package 050 has fund shifts to cover two or three different issues that came up. There's a $0.8 million general fund reduction, and it's mostly as an offset to higher than expected trust receipts. $1.1 million other funds expenditure limitation, and that is the increase for higher trust receipts. And finally, there's a $0.3 million federal funds expenditure limitation change for changes in Title 19 Medicaid match rate and changes in the random moment sample indirect administration federal fund parameters. On page 11, we have the final of the...
You want to tell us what that is? Can you say it three times fast?
Only if I can read it. The random moment sample is a way of determining the appropriate match rate, federal fund match rate, for work that is being done in the field. And it is literally, you get a call, what are you doing? Someone writes it down, and if you write down enough of those calls, you get a sense of what's being done, what's appropriate for federal funding, what is not. And once that's all processed, you know what your rate is for a federal fund match.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the other piece I would add relative to that, depending on what happens in, as a point in time between that and the Title 19 Medicaid match rate changes, that budgetarily we have shifted general funds and federal funds either to general fund or to federal funds depending on that funding parameter sample and the match rate change. And so this is a standard fund shift kind of thing that we go through as we build budgets. And then as we review the budget prior to work session, we'll look again at the Title 19 Medicaid match rate to update that. And that will be one of the adjustments that you'll see as we get into work session.
Continuing.
Go ahead, Linda.
Thank you. Continuing on page 11. There's a technical adjustment. It's $0. It simply moves $289,000 general fund from facilities to community programs. During the interim, we administratively moved positions from facilities to community programs, and this simply moves the appropriate services and supplies dollars to match those positions or to follow those positions. Beginning the policy packages, 081 biennializes the reductions in the 2002 third special session. It also includes salary range 38 and above cost of living adjustment reductions. Package 82 is from the fifth special session. House Bill 5100, Section 1. Section 1 had very specific reductions for agencies. This is a $0.2 million reduction. It eliminates the special appropriation for increased costs for the Deschutes Community Youth Investment Program and for the JBAR-J program. On the following page, page 12, we have the 090 package program reductions. This totals $1.1 million in general fund, $1.4 million total funds, and the reductions are in community programs, including diversion, the Multnomah gang funding, residential and foster care, and there is the reduction of one parole probation position. Package 091 follows up the fifth special session reductions, or biennializes the fifth special session reductions, and these were the unspecified ones. It totals $45.4 million in general fund. It continues the closure of 250 closed custody beds and 260 positions. In community programs, it eliminates shelter care and it reduces foster care. 19 parole and probation positions are eliminated and 2 program office positions. And finally, in administration, there are 6 positions that are eliminated in order to roll forward all the cuts in House Bill 5100, Section 2. Package 092, additional program reductions. This was where we took inflation out of the budget. You would notice probably that this $2.7 million general fund reduction, it's the inflation on services and supplies, and it's also on provider payments, special payments for in all the program units. The rest of the inflation was taken out in the 091 package for the fifth special session. It is assumed that that what rolled forward from that had its own inflation in it. And finally, on the last page, we have a technical adjustment. It eliminates one position, and it makes no difference in the funding. What had happened was that Washington County, since 1985, had used some of its diversion funding to fund a position within the Youth Authority. They've decided now that they'd rather just take the money, not have the position, and so that's all this technical adjustment is doing. No dollars. We may have another technical adjustment. Again, it would be zero funding, and it will result from a cost-benefit study that's being done now, and it's about whether it would be better to hire a position or to contract out for it. But we'll know more about that later.
And Linda, question on the technical adjustment, the new package. How many other kind of positions like this are ensconced within the Youth Authority's program? I mean, are there other counties besides Washington County that were reducing their diversion fund grants or other basic service grants that are...
Mr. Chair, I don't know, but...
This is the only one. Okay. I take that as a tacit yes, unless I see somebody from away rushing to the microphone. All right.
And, Mr. Chair, one last thing. On the last two lines of the technical adjustments page, it says positions full-time equivalent. Over on the right, it says it's 100.1% reduction. Of course, that is not true. It is 8.1% reduction in both cases.
It just feels like 101%.
Well, I can't speak to that.
I thought this was their 30% cut slip.
Yeah.
Thank you, Linda.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I will be walking you through the facility section in our presentation document, starting on page 27. I'd like to reiterate the point made by Director Brazeau yesterday that through the reductions and in the governor's balanced recommended budget, the pie chart top page to the left, we have made every attempt to maintain a balance between the facility and the field side of our service delivery. The goal of facility budget is to provide for public safety, accountability, and reformation opportunities to youth offenders who are too dangerous to the public or themselves to remain in the community. The OIA graduated series of sanctions for youth offenders includes a multi-tiered system now of 8 facilities located across the state. The population served, we have really 3 kinds of intake into the Oregon Youth Authority. One is youth offenders who are adjudicated as juveniles and committed by the juvenile court to the custody of Oregon Youth Authority. One group are those who have committed Measure 11 offenses, are adjudicated in adult court, committed to the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, and because of their age are transferred to the physical custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. And the third group are those who have been waived to adult court and are placed in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, and because of their age are placed in the physical custody of Oregon Youth Authority. On page 28, the characteristics of the youth that we serve. Again, we went over this in the overview. What we have seen since the reduction of the beds from 5,100 is there has been a shift in our close custody population. We have a higher portion of sex offenders in close custody than we have in the community. With the exception of Native American youth, minority youth are slightly higher represented in close custody, and female youth are slightly lower in their representation in close custody. And I believe that the director pointed out yesterday that the lower percentage of female offenders is not seen necessarily as a good thing, because we do not believe that there are necessarily appropriate services and sanctions in the community for these young women, that this may be a population that is underserved. The current age, 90% of the youth offenders that we are managing in the closed custody system are 20 years of age or younger. 60% of the youth offenders have committed person-to-person sex offenses or weapons offenses.
Bob, I think we went pretty much over most of this yesterday.
Okay.
A general overview. I know we're trying to get these budgets and timelines through.
Can we move
maybe to the facilities and physically, unless other people...
Okay.
I think we went over this pretty much yesterday on the general overview.
Excellent.
Okay.
Let's start with the youth correctional facilities, which you will find on page 29. They provide a high level of security, intensive accountability, and treatment designed to meet individual reformation needs of offenders with restitution to victims and communities. Offenders are housed generally in living units of 25. Reformation and medical services to this population are provided both by Oregon Youth Authority staff and contracted private providers that come into the facilities to provide services. Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility in Salem, co-gender, 180 beds. McLaren Youth Correctional Facility in Woodburn, older male offenders and the vast majority of the DOC male population. The Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility, 100 beds in Grants Pass, serves youth offenders, male, from the southern part of the state.
Bob, I have a question.
Sure.
In trying to blend these two characteristics of the closed custody and the facilities that are available, I know that you're going to rank the kind of, I would call it dangerousness or... What do you call it?
Risk.
What's the term? The
risk.
The risk of the youth that are in the various facilities around the state. Do we have something by county as to what the risk is, as to the type of risk factors they're putting in the facilities? So, say Jackson County has, their discretionary beds and other beds, their risk, the people they're putting in are at risk factor X, and the Mount Hood counties are at risk factor Y, and Washington counties are at risk factor whatever.
Mr. Chair, there is a document from Ms. Brazeau that I believe will answer that question. We have broken out the OYA population. By counting. Mr. Chair, we also have information that we can provide you on the youth that have been committed to the Oregon Youth Authority for placement in the youth correctional facility based on the commitment offense, the type of commitment offense.
Well, maybe I'll sit down and talk with you guys later and let you know what I want, and we'll walk through it.
From the Youth Authority, are you talking about an actual risk instrument like DOC uses to determine risk to reoffend?
What I'm wondering is by county, who's sending us the riskiest individuals? Is that a way to say it? Versus who's sending us individuals who don't have so much risk?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, probably the closest that we can get is based on risk or commitment offense or the history of the youth's offenses, and the youth, in dealing with youth, there is not a risk assessment. We wish that there was such a thing, but there is not one that has been normed for youth offenders. We have been working with national experts to determine if there, when and if such a risk assessment would be available for the general youth population and specifically for sex offenders. And largely, risk instruments are based on people's history. And because youth haven't been alive very long or don't have much of a history, offending history, there really hasn't been a good risk assessment developed that would be legally sound to be used. So we don't use one.
I can talk. I'm looking for something else to some degree. So we'll just keep going. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair,
that was just for the record. That was Karen. I don't know if Christine. I thought I caught it because I thought you said your name at the beginning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm working on page 30, our youth accountability camp in Tillamook, Oregon, 50 beds. This is a program that provides youth offenders with a structured, time-limited program that is based on cognitive restructuring, military drill, as well as alcohol and drug treatment. With less beds in the close custody system, this program has been forced to be more flexible in both the program design and the population that they serve. So we are undergoing some changes in the Tillamook Youth Accountability Camp program. Transition work study programs, 125 beds. These programs are specifically designed to bridge a youth placement from the youth correctional facility back to a community placement. They have opportunities to continue the reformation services that they have been participating in while in close custody. Education and vocational training continues. Job skill development through community service projects, supervised work crews, and community jobs to earn money for victim restitution is really the hallmark of these programs. We have contracts with the Parks Department, Forestry Department, as well as the Highway Department. Of these 125 beds, 25 are located in Corvallis and are dedicated to transitioning young women from Hillcrest back to their communities, 25 beds in Florence, 50 beds in Hillgard, which is the Riverbend facility, and 25 beds in Camp Tillamook, which is adjacent to the Youth Accountability Camp program in Tillamook. On page 31, assessment, statutory requirement that we do assessment and evaluation in six areas for all youth entering the youth authority system: their physical health, mental health, psychological, psychiatric, substance abuse, educational and vocational needs assessment, and offense-specific assessment such as violent offender, sex offender, and arson treatment. Karen yesterday referred to the chart with the two faces and the social characteristics of the youth that we serve in the Youth Authority, remembering that 62% have a diagnosed mental health disorder, 82% use, abuse, or dependent on alcohol. Required service provision within the Youth Authority, statutory reference, again, based on the assessment, medically appropriate health care for both mental and physical health, job skills and life skills training, substance abuse training, correctional treatment, violent offender, sex offender, and gang intervention, culturally specific treatment, and education. It should be noted that our educational programs in all of close custody are contracted through the Oregon Department of Education, usually with local education service districts to provide that. There is a box on the lower part of page 31 that shows some of the reformation services that are offered to youth in these facilities. Violent offender treatment is based on emotional ownership, moving youth to take emotional ownership for their violent offenses. Our sex offender treatment is a cognitive model. Parent training, 1 in 5 of the youth that we house are already parents. work experience restitution and accountability. Last year, 2002, combined community service unpaid work hours by youth in these beds, 44,835 community service hours were performed. At the bottom of the page, again, these services are provided both by OIA staff and through contracted professionals. Turning to page 32, improving closed custody facility performance. Since 1998, Oregon Youth Authority Correctional Facilities have participated in a national project titled Performance-Based Standards, or PBS. PBS measures specific standards in six areas: safety, security, mental and physical health, programming, order, and justice. Oregon was the first state to include all of our youth correctional facilities in this project, which is sponsored by the U.S. Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. Bottom of the page, there's two graphs. These are two examples of more than 100 standards that we measure in all of our facilities. If you look at the one on the right as an example, this shows a percentage of youth who received education programming as prescribed by their individual reformation plans. You'll see that the national average is about 75%. Oregon is 100%. This is a particularly, I think, insightful graph because it also points out that through our partnership with the Oregon Department of Education and local education school districts, we have been able to achieve some pretty impressive results in both education and vocational training programs in our facilities. Moving to page 33, factors that drive program cost. Statutory requirements resulting from Senate Bill 1, both the assessment and reformation services, which I previously articulated. I would like to make a comment on the assessment services that with reduced capacity and no statutory gatekeeping, counties can continue to send in as many youth as the court commits. It will be an additional workload on the youth authority to provide the assessment, make reformation plans, and develop reentry community-based supervision plans for the youth that will not be housed in close custody because of the reduction in capacity. The other factors that drive cost, yesterday Karen talked a bit about local county commitment and sentencing practices. Facility housing, again, we are 24/7 staffing on 25-bed units. We have health services that are required. Utilities, I would like to note that the Oregon Youth Authority exceeded the efficiency level required by the previous governor in the operation of our facilities through reduction in the use of utilities. Food, our partnership with DOC purchasing commodities. Currently, 30 to 40% of the commodities that we use in food preparation from McLaren and Hillcrest come from DOC, and we have achieved an economic efficiency by doing that. The bottom of page 33, you will see a chart that shows the average daily cost of juvenile close custody facilities. In the western states area, you will see that Oregon is on the lower end of those surveyed, but within the ballpark. On page 34, there is a continuum of out-of-home care placement resources for youth in the state of Oregon and a cost range showing a low end of those services that Oregon Youth Authority can use, which is our parental foster care at $38 a day, our close custody average facility cost at $139, the high end being Oregon State Hospital Child and Adolescent Treatment Services at $552. You will notice in the far right-hand column that some of these costs are offset with Medicaid funds coming in. Governor's reductions to the facility budget. We closed four regional facilities as a result of House Bill 5100. North Coast in Warrenton with 75 beds was closed the 1st of March of 03. Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility, 75 beds, Albany, closed on March the 15th of 03. and the Ochoco Youth Correctional Facility in Prineville with 50 beds, along with the Eastern Oregon Correctional Facility in Burns at 50 beds, was closed on February the 15th of 03. The following reductions were also taken in close custody. The Riverbend Facility, 25 beds, that's located in Hillgard outside of LeGrand. McLaren Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facilities, additional 56 beds. Additional governor's reduction, eliminate cost of living increase, service and supplies at 3%. Management increases, salary range 38 and above, and additional two management positions. The OIA close custody capacity has now been reduced by 331 beds, approximately 30% of our total capacity. Offenders with the most serious risk were moved via these closures to the remaining facilities that were open. Others were fast-tracked to parole. The option of transitioning to community residential aftercare was and will remain unavailable to many offenders given similar reduction in our community program side of the budget. Close custody youth characteristics after the reductions were implemented. This shows the shift in our population pre and post closure of these beds. We increased from what had been 40% of our population as sex offenders to 50%. We increased Hispanic youth from 11 to 13% of our population. Caucasian youth decreased from 72 to 70%. Females decreased from 11 to 9%. The reduction in close custody capacity returns OIA to pre-1995 Senate Bill 1 levels for juvenile offenders, returning to a system which lacks ability to swiftly and decisively intervene and to address delinquency and reform young offenders. I think it's important to recognize that the youth that have been removed from close custody, there will be an ongoing reduction in the access to close custody for judges to hold youth offenders accountable in local communities. On page 36, you see a map of where the facilities are located. The facilities that have been closed are highlighted. On page 37, you will see the detail from the governor's budget summary, which Linda Gilbert went through. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about our facilities.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question I particularly don't like asking, but I think it might be necessary. You've had a significant number of closures already, but if the budget situation became such that we had to consider that as an option for OIA in terms of further reductions in facilities, have you discussed internally where those reductions would be in terms of numbers of beds, which facilities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, we have developed a number of optional scenarios reflecting the potential of additional reductions with two values, one trying to preserve some continuum of services within the youth authority as well as looking at the cost and the services offered in those facilities.
Hold on. In that discussion, have you seen a necessity that would give you, I'm not saying that any of these decisions would be desirable, that you would still want to maintain some of the transition capabilities versus hard beds in the other facilities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that's a very good question. And what we have seen from both research and from our county partners and our parole and probation officers that provide this community supervision for youth being released is that it is beneficial and in some cases imperative to do a decompression from the more rigid and secure facilities prior to community placement. And those transition programs do serve that purpose. We have in all locations with the exception of two in transition programs added security fencing to them. So the level of security has been increased with those programs.
I have a couple questions for you,
sir.
Mr. Jester. I'm going back to the page, that the one-page handout that you gave us on the Oregon Youth Authority County Comparison on the OIA population. I go to kind of the, I tried to look at kind of the big six counties to see where we were at. I looked at Clackamas, Jackson, Lane, Marion, Multnomah, and Washington. And what I noticed was with Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties, the percentage of the risk population, if I'm reading your chart correctly, the risk population is the number of juveniles in the community. Is that correct? And the total as a percent of the state population means the total is a percentage of the state population in custody. Is that correct?
Yes. Karen Brazetta says yes.
So do you
yes.
want to come up here, Karen? My question is, why is the utilization for the large counties much less by a percentage basis than those of the small counties? What are they doing differently?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Karen Brazil, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. Many of the larger counties have local resources that help them deal with kids locally.
Meaning?
A variety of local options, sometimes even residential options. For example, you heard Joanne Fuller yesterday talking about some of the local programs that they've been able to fund with state dollars, one of which is a residential alcohol and drug treatment program. They get enough money from the state that they could actually put together a program like that. Smaller counties don't get enough money. They don't have the mass of youth in any one place to really put together that kind of a residential program and end up sending kids that the kids themselves perhaps could be treated locally, but there isn't a local option for them. We are seeing, however, even counties who have been underutilizing per their share, such as Washington County, begin to send more and more kids.
Okay. Because you have several counties who are using double their fair share. I mean, double their fair share potentially.
That's right.
And I guess that's why I'm trying to get to the risk population, to have a better understanding of where we're at on a county-by-county basis.
That's right, and we should probably, if you really want to get into this discussion, we provided this just based on
conversation yesterday,
and we also have one, and it's in the back of your book, I believe, that is just shows the close custody situation and how the so-called discretionary beds are allocated, and even Appendix 8 can see how the counties use their discretionary beds. And if you wanted to get into this, we could prepare additional information based on their use of discretionary beds, Measure 11 beds, public safety reserve beds. You'd have to have all of the information, I think, broken down by community bed use and various categories of beds.
I guess my concern is that we have the adequate beds for the bad actors versus the adequate beds for maybe those who could remain in the community. And I guess
we are very prepared with the data to come back and show that in all of the categories, which it doesn't exactly represent risk, but it does represent criminality.
All right. Well, I'd like to talk with you. I mean, we don't have to sit here and belabor it. Maybe we can figure out how we can condense that into maybe a shorter presentation.
Okay. We can.
With the items. Are other committee members interested in looking at that particular piece? My second question on the OIA budget in regards to your facilities piece is your transition and work-study programs. What percentage of your youth go through those who are what's the profile? They've been in a hard bed, they go to one of these transitional work study programs. What percentage of your people are
going through these types of programs?
Mr. Chair, we can get you an exact number. I would say that the majority of the youth leaving our system go through one of our transitional programs, and they represent the full range of youth that we serve in our other facilities. It's a matter of how long they may have been in that facility before they are appropriate in terms of reduction of public safety risk to transition back to their community.
And then I had a question back on this page one more time. Sorry, I keep bumping back and forth. On the Deschutes program, they're really using less than half of the state resources. So they're really, they're putting up a substantial amount of resources there and not burdening the state resources.
.5 versus 3.6. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Deschutes situation is somewhat confusing to look at on this page because it has to do with their pilot project that they have chosen according to the rules associated with the pilot. They take cash in exchange for access to the state beds.
But the cash is not reflected.
Okay,
then we can talk about that later. Okay. All right. Any other questions on the facilities portion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I appreciate you bringing up the population issue and the utilization of these facilities. As you know, in House District 60, we lost the facility there in Burns, the Eastern Oregon, and the staff provided me with some information about the offenses of all of the youth that were released, and I just wanted to know what the status was with the youth that had been released, the offenses that they have recommitted, if any, and what their status is at present. If we have had to bring any of these youngsters back in, have they violated parole? Do we have other issues? And that was one of the things you'd mentioned, Bob, was that you were shifting a group of these folks over to additional parole locally, and I noticed that they were still on parole locally.
Representative Butler, you're absolutely right. We have been tracking the cohort of youth that were released as a result of the closures in the capacity within close custody. And of those released, we did a survey of our field staff who are managing these cases and use the juvenile justice information system and use actual data for youth that have been returned to close custody, as well as sensitive issue reports that we receive in the director's office about behavior of youth in the community. Currently, we are showing 148 of the released youth to be stable and appropriately engaged with their parole agreement. In other words, they are either attending school, working, or actively seeking employment. 24 youth have new law violations. I do not have those broken out, but we could get that information for you. 71 youth have new technical violations of their placement agreement, which would include runaway. So a group of these youth would no longer be under our supervision because they have run away, and we are not providing supervision to them, so we're not sure where they are, what they're doing.
An obscon, in effect.
Exactly.
Okay.
And 84 of these youth have been categorized by our parole and probation staff as being at risk of revocation. And as Director Brazeau spoke yesterday, there is a percentage of revocations that come back into close custody for technical violations as opposed to new law violations, and this is often a preventive measure to prevent further law violation. And the reduction in the capacity does provide challenges for our parole and probation officers to both provide community protection and to hold youth accountable if there is not detention and there's not longer-term capabilities in close custody. So that's a very good question.
Just to follow up, though, you got 71 that are presently at OPSCON. The 84 at risk of revocation, those are not mutually exclusive with the other categories, the new violations, stable, and new technical OPSCON. So if I'm getting 84 at risk of revocation, certainly that would include the 71 that's a runaway, wouldn't it?
I would need to verify that. But I would like to clarify on the 71 that these are 71 youth offenders who have committed new technical violations, which could include runaway.
Oh, I
could
see.
Be a dirty urinalysis, could be having contact with other adjudicated youth who are on parole probation, could have contact with excluded groups such as younger children, et cetera.
Okay. But I'm just so what I'm looking for is the 84 at risk of revocation are not mutually exclusive from the other group. What did we release? A total of 250 youngsters, as I recall. Something of that.
Yes, that's correct, sir.
So if we've released 250, it looks like the 24, 48, and the 71, maybe approaching that number, with 84 at risk of revocation, which would include the OBSCON and new technical and some of the new violations, but most of the stable and engaged in parole agreements and so forth would not necessarily appear to be at risk of revocation.
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trying to do some math in my head, it looks like about 40% would be in risk of revocation and probably not on the right track. How does that compare with previous release data that you'd have from pre-major 28 or kind of period before we got into this budget crisis?
Representative Hansen, that's an excellent question, too. The previous revocation rate is about 26-27%.
This is so close to 40%, 36%.
Follow up. If the previous rate of revocation was 26%, and we're saying we've got about 40 that are at risk of revocation, but not all of the ones at risk would necessarily be revoked. So I don't know if that would be typical or if the numbers are going up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, let us provide you a one page when we return that better lays this out. This was pulled together very quickly. We wanted to get the latest information before we testified before you.
That update would be helpful. Thank you. With any supplemental data, Bob, that you might be able to provide us relative to the severity of the crimes that on these new violations, I'm anxious to know what the status of that is.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're done with your presentation then?
Yes.
Okay. Sheila, what's next? I'm sorry.
We're doing community programs next. Brian.
Okay.
Thorpe.
Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Thorpe with the Youth Authority. I'll be presenting the community program section of the OA budget this afternoon, and that starts on page 39 of the document you have in front of you. I'd like to start by reiterating yesterday's discussion by Chair Patridge and members of the committee, and as presented by Director Brazeau and the juvenile directors, the staff in the community programs, plus the services that they provide and coordinate, really provide the critical balance for the secure facilities in our system. And I wanted to start with that point. And I think in looking at the goal statement on page 39, purpose of these community programs is to provide consistent overarching case management for youth offenders, focusing on the goal of protecting the public by reducing their risk of future criminal activity. And this case management consists of supervision by these POs, supported by a graduated series of community-based responses and services. You can see in the pie chart there at the top of page 39 that the community programs budget represents about 40% of the overall OA budget. And you can see in the lower pie chart the breakdown of how those funds are spent. I would point out that approximately 75% of the community program's budget is outsourced to private providers or local jurisdictions so that they can provide those services to minimize youth risk. In the presentation today, I'll be speaking about parole and probation services, talking about our partnerships and how we do quality improvement in the agency. I would point out that the majority of the services we'll be talking about today are targeted at youth offenders, but that OIA parole officers and our treatment managers in the facilities are very engaged with the Department of Corrections in their Oregon accountability model in preparing those DOC offenders for transition, both in preparing the plans and in implementing them. So while we'll be speaking to youth offenders, in most of the references in the community program section, there's clearly a role for agency staff in preparing the offenders we have custody of in getting ready for their release. Page 40, you can see the charts that you've seen in other parts of our agency's budget. This speaks to the characteristics of youth and community programs. On page 41 begins a discussion about parole and probation services. And I would point out that we serve youth in the youth authority under two different court jurisdiction status. The first is probation, where the courts commit these youth to us for community-based supervision and services. The second is for parole and youth correctional facility commitment. These youth start out placed by the court in our youth correctional facilities. We begin case management of the case from that point of commitment, and we develop an appropriate transition plan and then follow up with supervision and service when the youth offender returns to the community. The case management process I'm talking about doesn't necessarily follow a linear path. Youth tend to move back and forth in the system a little bit, so there's continual assessment and monitoring. That's a critical, important part of the role of the parole and probation officers and the supportive staff. And the delivery of service and supervision is adjusted throughout the life of the case. At the bottom of page 41, you can see some of the key functions of parole and probation officers. Clearly, they're key in developing the individual reformation plan and seeing that it's implemented, supervising and monitoring court-ordered conditions. They coordinate community resources. They play an integral part in the parole youth's close custody treatment team. They provide a communication link between youth offender and their family if the youth offender is placed outside the family home. And they ensure youth offenders' accountability to the community and to the victims of their crimes. The individual reformation plan that I've talked about is reflective of the unique case dynamics of these youth. It identifies areas of risk and need for service. It provides guidelines for treatment and reformation activities. It emphasizes accountability and restoration to the victims, and it's intended to develop linkages among the various agencies and persons who will be involved with that case. There are several key tenets that guide us in the provision of services. Those include partnerships with local juvenile departments so that we coordinate and show some efficiency in how we deliver services to youth. We use best practice principles guided by research. We're working currently to establish case management guidelines in our field structure. And we also have embraced the tenets of the intensive aftercare program that speak to the importance of preparing a youth for release while they're in secure custody, making connection to the resources and supports in the community, and then implementing those services as they do return. A key component in the community program section are our residential services. This continuum had included foster care, shelter care, and residential. We were forced to eliminate the shelter care component as part of the reductions during 0103, so I'll just be speaking to residential and to foster care. In the residential category, there are two main areas of service. One is residential programs that provide a variety of service in settings ranging from a family environment of a therapeutic foster model to a staff-secure residential setting. I would point out that the majority of these services are provided by private nonprofit entities through contract with the Youth Authority. And for your reference, on page 46, a little deeper in the document, there's a map that shows the distribution of those residential programs. We also have two programs that provide residential alcohol and drug programs on a 24-hour-a-day residential basis. One is the Morrison Breakthrough Program in Portland. The other is Rosemont, which serves young women also in the Portland area. All of our residential programs are supported with federal Medicaid funds through a program called Behavior Rehabilitation Services. BRS provides for assessment, skill building, counseling, and provides a structured therapeutic environment for the youth that are in these residential settings. And we also have established a system of quality assurance and monitoring for the residential programs. It's based on the PBS program that Bob described in facilities. So there are appropriate standards for community service that are monitored regularly, and quality improvement plans are developed. OA's foster care program is one that we inherited from the Department of Human Services. It was based on a welfare model. We still operate family-based foster care in the Youth Authority. We have begun, however, a transition to multidimensional therapeutic foster care that has been proven to be effective for some juvenile corrections populations. This conversion is ongoing. We're working with the Oregon Social Learning Center in Eugene to try to replicate the key components of their blueprint model for this service delivery system. And you can see in the bullets on page 44 what some of those key components in that model are. They include serving only one youth in a home at a time, providing a comprehensive array of support services to the youth as they're living in the home, establishing a network of support and 24-hour crisis response for the foster parents, assuring that we appropriately recruit and train these foster parents so they're prepared for the demands of foster parenting a juvenile youth offender. We provide periodic respite and ongoing developmental training to these foster homes. And I would point out that there is significant behavioral monitoring and intervention changes for the youth as they reside in these homes. So it's a little different than the family foster care that we run in some other settings. On page 45, you can see a chart that details the rate structure for most of the community programs that OA contracts for. And in the center there, you can see the close custody figure that Bob spoke to earlier. I would point out the significant Medicaid support for the BRS programs. It shows in the far right column there. Page 46 is the map that shows the distribution we talked about. Again, we did lose shelter care that was positioned around the state in many of our communities. And you can see in the detail of the chart, there are programs with asterisks next to their name. Each of those programs did experience some reduction during 0103 in capacity that they had previously enjoyed. On page 47, I talked for a minute about individual community services. This program is intended to provide a way to resource individual treatment and support services in response to whatever unique circumstances might be present in a youth offender's reformation plan. These services are delivered in several ways. One is by the development of a wraparound service plan, and this simply is a plan that addresses individual needs that are not readily available in kind of component care like residential services. We also develop independent living kind of transition plans for older youth who are really not going to be living with family, directed more toward living on their own. There is a set of programs intended to help sex offender youth as they transition from facilities back to the community. And we also have a nationally recognized minority youth transition program that promotes positive transition for OI youth correctional facility kids back to their communities. These services are culturally specific. It's a co-gender program serving both young men and young women. And the services are specific to primarily African American and Hispanic youth, although we've also had Asian and Native American youth that were successfully involved in the program. On page 48, there's a description of community partnerships that OA is involved in. These partnerships emphasize the collaborative way that we work with other juvenile justice entities. I would point out that our key partners are the county juvenile departments, and as you've heard, we are entered into co-management agreements that define our responsibilities and collaborations with all 36 counties. There are also intergovernmental agreements that define the state diversion funds provided to counties for the development and operation of community-based options that are designed to divert youth offenders from OA commitment. OA also has a significant role in the provision of juvenile crime prevention services as mandated in Senate Bill 555. OA's budget contains approximately $8 million to be distributed to the counties, the juvenile departments, for the provision of basic services. I think you heard Joanne Fuller and Georgia Stewart speak about the basic service grants yesterday. The planning process for juvenile crime prevention basic services and the diversion program have been combined at the local level to provide better coordination. OA also has a resource directed to Multnomah County for youth gang services. We've been involved with Multnomah County for approximately 12 years in this partnership, targeting those resources at gang involved youth. We also have in the governor's balanced budget the Deschutes County Delinquent Youth Investment Project. Director Brazil spoke to that briefly. I would point out that funding for that project was eliminated in House Bill 5548 for the remainder of this biennium, but it's still contained in the governor's balanced budget. On page 49, this will be a detail of some of the program office services. Director Brazil spoke to you about these functions already, about quality assurance in her overview. I'd highlight a couple of things. The Research and Development Unit is responsible for data analysis, tracking national research, keeping us pointed toward best practice and evidence-based approaches. Community Resource Unit is responsible for the community contracts and monitoring and maintaining quality assurance there. And then training and development is an important part of the agency, especially as we experience the changes that we have. We have responded to needs. I would point out an example being suicide prevention training, which is now a mandated training for all staff that's provided through our own training and development program. On page 50, this is a summary of the reductions contained in the governor's balanced budget. And I'll go through those briefly. This budget eliminates 21 positions from parole and probation. It eliminates professional shelter care capacity that was funded by the Youth Authority. Residential capacity is reduced, foster care capacity reduced, as is individual services that were described earlier. County diversion, juvenile crime prevention, basic services, Multnomah County Youth Gang, and Deschutes County programs all experienced proportionate reductions, and there were elimination of a cost of living, increases in service and supply, special payments, and the 3% increase for managers of salary ranges 38 and above. You can see the proportion of those reductions is displayed in that pie chart. Page 51 is the summary of the detail for community programs. I'd be glad to answer any questions the committee might have.
Representative Gantz. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the residential treatment centers, we're flipping back and forth between the current cost comparison and most of the beds in these facilities receive Medicaid match?
Chair Patridge, Representative Hansen, yes. In the residential category, all of our current contracts access Medicaid support through DHS.
I guess when we look at the cost, then, of what was the rationalization in terms of reducing those versus state custody beds? It would seem to me we'd get more bang for the buck if we're utilizing those to the maximum extent.
Chair Patrick, Representative Hansen, I think your statement is true that there is an efficiency in gaining the federal funds. I believe we looked at the continuum of service and the relative risk of youth and these programs' ability to take these youth in the communities. And certainly all youth do end up returning to the community, but I think a course of secure care is certainly in order for many, and then they're better able to access and benefit from the services that these residential programs could provide.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Sheila?
On the agenda for today, I had thought that we wouldn't get any farther than this point. We can go, I believe the agency is prepared to talk about the administration and capital and debt service budgets if you are willing to go there.
I'm happy to go there.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Karen Olson. I manage business services for the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm going to start with capital on page 53. This page shows the facilities that OIA owns, and it gives you a sense of the condition of those facilities. You'll notice most of them are in good to excellent condition. We operate a total of 8 facilities in various locations around the state, as Bob mentioned. We own another 4 facilities, which were closed in the last couple of months. We provide basic maintenance and security services to those facilities to assure that they'll remain usable for the state in the future. In addition, Wynn County operates a detention unit in our facility in Albany. And yesterday, Georgia Stewart testified about, I think, the disruption to Clatsop County from having to take youth to Washington State for detention. Clatsop County commissioners have stated their intention of operating detention in Warrington on July 1st, and so we're working on a lease with them to allow them to do that. In total, OAA has a physical capacity of 1,131 beds. We also have 30 beds that are coming online at Hillcrest. We approached the emergency board during the interim to request limitation to expend $1 million in federal grant money that comes from the Oregon State Police. This is the Federal Violent Offender Incarceration Truth in Sentencing Grant Program. And we're going to use that funding to renovate Scott Hall, which will provide an additional 50 beds of usable capacity, thereby bringing our physical capacity within the system to 1,181 beds and 50 detention beds. We maintain our facilities well, and the condition of them, the facilities and the buildings, is generally good. However, on page 54, I do want to point out three issues for you. The first thing I'd like to talk about is some temporary structures that we're currently utilizing. We have 100 beds in soft-sided structures at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility, and we have 50 beds at Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility in two modular structures. These units are still in good shape, but they were never intended to permanently house youth. So at some point in the future, we may need to change the use of those facilities. The second thing I'd like to point out is Whitaker Hall at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility is in need of either significant repair or replacement. This building is 78 years old, and in 1998, we contracted with a company to provide us a survey of the condition of our older facilities. They found deficiencies totaling approximately 40% of the replacement cost of Whitaker Hall. And therefore, while there is not funding in the governor's budget for this replacement, we need to be thinking about what we will do in the future to house the administrative units at the facility and a canteen where youth work. The third issue I'd like to point out is around our young women's transition program, which is housed in Corvallis. Corvallis House was constructed in 1913. It's been used for a variety of sources. It was a residence, it was a fraternity, it was a DOC halfway house. We used it for a program for boys, and now we use it for a program for girls. The structure is below, its condition is below average for its age because of the multiple uses that it's had. It's larger than needed for our current use. We don't use the third floor at all. It's somewhat inefficient to operate. However, its location is great. It's located centrally, and it's easy for the youth to get to various activities. As we look at the programs that we need for young women after the cuts we've recently taken, this may prompt a decision about what to do with this property in the future. On page 55, you have a little bit of information on asset protection. We do have an automated system that controls when we do preventive maintenance. And then we have produced a 6-year capital management plan, which is presented on pages 56 and 57. The agency has about $210 million in funding for capital improvements. We also take some money from our maintenance budgets to provide for smaller projects that protect our assets. And you can see over the total of 6 years, we have a number of project plans that we will accomplish if funding is available.
Karen, can I just ask you a question relative to these facilities? Mm-hmm. Are there any facilities that are owned by the Oregon Youth Authority or under the care of Oregon Youth Authority presently that are not being utilized? When we talk about the Corvallis House, it sounds like it's probably something around 50% utilization. Are there other facilities that are owned or operated that are significantly underutilized or not utilized at all?
Representative Butler, we are still utilizing Corvallis House. We utilize two floors. We have at Whitaker Hall, the third floor is condemned, and we are not utilizing that. But on the most part, the entire physical facility is utilized.
Okay. And then, of course, we have the mothball facilities from Burns and Primeville and Warrenton. What's our present cost of mothballing these facilities?
Representative Butler, we have about $400,000 in this budget for mothballing. About 40% of that is for utilities, and then we have funding for security contracts and other issues.
But other than the mothballed and then the third floor of the one facility, third floor of two facilities, Whitaker Hall and Corvallis House, everything else is utilized to its fullest extent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, it is.
Okay. All right. Thank you. No other property owned or not being utilized by the Oregon Youth Authority then?
Mr. Chair, Karen Brazil, for the record. Representative Butler, I think an oversight. The Oak Creek facility in Albany is also mothballed. It's listed there. I think just an oversight that you didn't list it in.
Isn't Oak Creek being operated by the county, though?
Only the detention unit is.
Oh, okay.
The remainder of it is closed.
And how many beds there are closed?
Representative Patridge and Representative Butler, 75 beds there are closed, and then the Linn County operates the other 20.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay, on page 57, at the bottom of that page, we show our debt service. We have debt service for three major purposes. The first one of those is we sold $42 million in certificates of participation to finance the construction of the five regional facilities. Then we sold additional COPs to finance security fences at McLaren and Hillcrest, for furnishings and landscaping for the new regional facilities, and to remodel Hillcrest to deal with issues arising from suicides at that facility. And lastly, we paid for a majority of the development of the juvenile justice information system with certificates of participation. Our debt service for 2003-05 is $10.6 million. During the next biennium, we will pay off all COPs except those related to the initial construction of the five regional facilities. Does anybody have any questions on capital?
Representative Hansen.
How long will it, thank you, Mr. Chair, how long will it take to pay off the regional facility COPs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, they'll be paid off in 2012.
Okay.
I want to move to page 60, talk about administration.
I have just a question in regard to that.
Representative Butler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Probably for Linda. Is there a mechanism if, for instance, on those regional facilities that COP financed, that the Department of Corrections took some of that over, would they then assume the debt obligation? Or would that be a lease, interagency lease? How would that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, there may be a variety of ways to set that up. I'm not sure exactly what the answer is, but I can come back with something better than a variety. Sheila, do you have an idea?
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, I'm not sure exactly how it works, but the actual issuance of debt was in the name of the Department of Administrative Services rather than the OIA specifically or DOC specifically. But I'm not sure what the check writing arrangements are for that.
So if some of these were shifted from one agency to the next, then we could shift the obligation for the COP participation then?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. On page 60, we've got administration. As both Sheila and Linda have shown in their previous charts, administration is 9% of the budget. On the pie chart at the top of this page, I've broken it into two pieces. because within administration we have the director's office in business services, which provides central support, oversight, and leadership for the agency. But also within the administration budget, we have agency-wide costs such as insurances and charges that we pay to other state agencies that are not necessarily administrative in nature. 6% of this budget is our central administration. It contains the director's office and a centralized business services function. In business services, these functions are all provided centrally to the agencies. Facilities and field offices do not have staff performing business services functions. And those functions are your accounting, payroll purchasing, budget development, contract solicitation and development, personnel or employee services, and as Karen Brazil mentioned the other day, information systems, which includes the support of OIA and the development and support of the Juvenile Justice Information System. One thing I would like to mention that is in your document, but Karen didn't talk about the other day, on page 24, we have recently developed an offshoot of the Juvenile Justice Information System. It's called the Juvenile Justice Partner System. It's a specific JAGIS component designed for local public safety agencies, and it provides case data that is public data, data that can be released to the public. We currently have 14 organizations with JJPS access. JJPS is allowing us to bring Multnomah County onto the system and provide access to JAGIS that a lot of folks had to the former Multnomah County system. And if you you or your local partners are interested in getting access to JAGIS, contact your local juvenile director, and they can approve that.
Okay.
Okay, on page 61, talked about the agency-wide budget. This pays for intergovernmental service charges, so it pays for our Secretary of State's audits. It pays for assessments to DAS, to the services they provide. It also funds tort and property insurance premiums, unemployment insurance, attorney general services, and other charges. Once again, it's 3% of the budget. Changes in the administration budget over time are linked basically to three factors. The first is we respond to program changes. When there are program increases or there are program decreases, we need to look at the size of administration. Secondly, one of the major drivers in administration has been the development and continued operation of the statewide juvenile justice information system. And third, changes in intergovernmental charges, such as insurances, can be major drivers, as they are this biennium, in increase in costs in administration. The reductions in the governor's budget here, we have a reduction of 6 positions and the services and supplies commensurate with these. All inflation on services and supplies except for state government service charges is eliminated, and the elimination of the 3% salary increase for managers, salary range 38 and above. These reductions reflect decreasing workload due to program cuts, changing functions to perform more efficiently, and providing fewer services. On page 62, there's a summary of this budget, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
All right.
I have some JJPS brochures, and I'll leave with you in case anyone is interested in taking them back to their local law enforcement agency.
Any further questions? Karen, I did have a couple questions, probably for both you and Bob, prior to, I'm going to ask kind of the same types of questions tomorrow. I'm just interested, since we've mothballed these facilities and released people out into the community on the discretionary beds predominantly, what kind of impact those have had on the local community for the record. I mean, I think I have a good idea, but...
Mr. Chair, when you were out of the room, Representative Butler asked some questions, and we said we would get back tomorrow with a more thorough report. We do have set up in JAGIS
that population of kids to track separately, and we do track them by name. And I have the whole list of them we could go through. And we do have some summary data, but as we
That's fine.
We're reporting that, we found we weren't able to answer all of Representative Butler's questions, so we were going to...
So we'll lead with that tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll lead with that with about a 10-minute piece, and then we'll move on from there. I'm also interested in your abilities to manage these institutions, your continued ability because of the higher acuity, higher acuity, higher criminality of the offenders who are in the institutions, how or if that's affected your ability to manage the institutions, what it's done to employee safety in terms of, you know, those people who are supervising.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think right now it would be difficult to specify exactly the changes that have gone on in the institutions relative to the different risk of the kids relative to the changes in our staff. Anytime you have a staff layoff and management changes and changes in kids the way we have had, I mean, we've literally moved hundreds of kids and hundreds of staff and dozens of managers through this process. So virtually everything has been changed upside down, which causes a lot of instability. Even so, I have to say that we have had, I hate to voice it, but we have had pretty good stability. I was most concerned moving towards the closure of the facilities that we would have staff kind of losing heart in their jobs and not showing up for work, just playing out their sick leave. That happened in very few cases. People worked until the very last day because they were very dedicated to the kids and concerned about the instability and the effect on the kids. I have been very concerned about the potential for suicide attempts. We have not seen much of an increase in that. We have seen an increase in staff injuries, not necessarily as a result of related to kids, but overall our trend line on staff injuries has been going down, so it's a little early to tell. For the most part, the staff are well trained and people have pulled together and tried to provide stability to the kids, and that's what makes the difference. So, and as I think those of you who have toured McLaren saw, the older kids who for the most part have stayed at McLaren have matured and they've had longer sentences, and they provide a lot of stability. It sounds weird, but they do provide a lot of stability for the younger, squirrelier kids, and that has helped as the younger kids have moved in and then moved out. But a great deal of the stability, I think, just has to be, the credit has to be given to the staff, both on the field side and on the institution side, for their pure, heartfelt dedication to the kids.
Can you talk to us maybe a little bit about the psychology that goes on amongst the juvenile offender population in terms of, and this is just purely shooting in the dark, but we had these regional facilities all before, and you put a lot of the less bad actors or the those with less criminality into the regional facilities to a greater degree, is my understanding. And then McLaren kind of housed the more hardcore types of offenders. What's that done to the psychology of the juvenile delinquent? I mean, you don't have that option necessarily anymore. You don't have that option necessarily at the local level to kind of have the kind of have a progressive discipline system, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Well, Bob, who used to be the superintendent at McLaren, and Gary's here, and he might be able to talk about it, what's on the ground today with the kids. I may have mentioned that I talked two Fridays ago to the defense bar, and I was really disheartened about what they told me, that they are already advising the kids that they defend. The judge may tell you you're going to go to McLaren and do 3 months, 6 months, 8 months. Don't believe it. You'll be out in a couple weeks, unless the kid has really committed a serious offense. So that's the psychology or the mindset of the lower-level offense kids.
Mr. Chair, I think that as we were reducing the population and closing these regional facilities, I want to just underscore Karen's comment about our staff. We obviously could not have gotten to where we are without our staff, both the field and the facility, and they performed incredible tasks, both in shutting down these facilities, moving youth to new programs, getting them ready, but also developing reentry plans for youth that weren't quite ready to go out, or they wouldn't have.
Oftentimes, while the staff themselves were moving.
Well, and exactly. I mean, in the regional facilities, these were staff that were not going to.
Karen Purcell, for the record.
That's right. Bob Jester didn't say that. But these were staff that were, in fact, also being displaced. One of the advantages of the larger facilities, for those of you that have seen both of them operating, the smaller facilities, Eastern Central, had two living units. McLaren has 19 living units. And so there's the gear compound, there is the soft-sided structure compound, and there are the eight front cottages. We have the ability to set up continuum of privileges and sanctions within that environment, and we have a self-contained secure program both at McLaren and Hillcrest. So the larger institutions do provide some flexibility. The psychology of the youth are there. Karen's absolutely right. If these facilities had not closed in the end, we would have had major problems with a lot of kids because they were sure they were the ones who were being picked to go out. They had heard about these transition plans. Parole probation staff were meeting with them, talking about where they're going to go, and they were fully planning on not being with us in these facilities. So there is that psychology of youth believing that even though the judge said, I'm going to be here for a year, I'm not going to be. And that's really the revolving door, we call it the revolving door syndrome. The best investment that this committee can make in public safety is one vacant bed for a youth offender. Because as long as there's one vacant bed and you're in the community acting out, you can believe it's for you. But if all the beds are full, you can tell yourself, you know, I know it's full. My buddies went in and got out real quickly. So that's a piece of psychology as well.
And I guess But would you agree with what Karen said based upon her conversations with the defense attorneys that people are really right now believing that it isn't a revolving door? I guess I'm just concerned with the youth that we can't deal with. I mean, I felt like the same way when we were dealing with, I was at a deputy DA when we were doing 1145.
Right.
I would have not been a person who voted for 1145 in the legislature had it occurred at that point in time, because I dealt with a lot of kind of penny ante offenders who ran around, and their big fear was is anything greater than 6 months, they were going to the state penitentiary, you know, and people wanted to avoid that, and there was some knowledge of that particular part of criminality. I mean, there are sociopaths and other people. There's some psychology. So,
Mr. Chair, I totally agree with that. And I think that Karen's comments that she heard from the defense bar are reflective of what youth in the community will be hearing and telling each other. That will come to fruition.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit, too, while we have you here. And also, we talked a little bit when the juvenile directors came up about the blend. How do we blend prevention versus kind of the basic service grants versus the discretionary beds and the hard beds? Can you talk a little bit about how you came to the conclusions that you did, and if we have to look at the total spectrum? I mean, you've provided us with priority
different things, but as you look at the whole spectrum, how does that work? How does that come into play?
The information that we provided to you, Mr. Chair, is primarily the effort of the Youth Authority working with its primary partners, the Juvenile Department directors, and some meetings that we've had with our contractors and some meetings that we've had with both of the unions that we work with. And our belief as the Youth Authority's management that the continuum is critical, particularly the continuum between close custody and the field services, that it really, all of the critical research around juvenile offenders tells us that everything that is gained in close custody is lost if there isn't an appropriate step-down program for the youth when he or she leaves close custody. So we have always tried to achieve a balance as the system grows or shrinks between close custody and community-based resources. So that's a priority. And the diversion funds are important, I think, somewhat analogous to the community corrections situation that exists on the adult side, that the Youth Authority has contracts with all of the counties now that in effect says, in exchange for maintaining your limit on access to the discretionary beds, the state will provide you with X number of diversion dollars, and the county, in agreement, signs a contract and accepts diversion dollars. And those dollars are targeted at the group of kids who are most likely to commit the crimes that would get them into the Youth Authority. And our concern has been, because we've heard from the Juvenile Department directors, that as those dollars diminish, they might refuse to sign those contracts. And we rely heavily on them to work with the judges in their counties who have clearly the right and often the predilection to just keep sending kids no matter what the cap is. And when they do that, that puts the burden on us to parole kids to make room for the next kid coming out, which creates the revolving door. And then it's just a poor use of resources. So it's very much an agreement to try to maintain a balance that makes the best use of the resources, no matter how many there are or how few there are. So that's, I think, where the priority comes from. And the chart that I had up here the first day I spoke, talking about where the real increase in violent juvenile crime stems from, and that's the adolescent kids, I think speaks for the need for prevention funds targeting those adolescent kids. Does that help?
How does the committee wrestle with? We've heard from Criminal Justice Commission. We talked about juvenile crime prevention grants. How do we wrestle with, from the Youth Authority's perspective, how do we wrestle with whether we fund on the front end those prevention grants, or whether, is that a better return on our dollar, or whether we look at maybe like these diversion types of grants, discretionary bed pieces? What's the basis of comparison for looking at the effective? I know it's apples and oranges, but as we struggle with our apples and oranges this session, can you give us maybe an idea of how we can look at those?
Well, geez.
Do you want me to bring Phil and you guys can?
No, I sure wish Craig Campbell was in the room. I guess the diversion.
I mean, the crime prevention dollars were voted on really last legislative session, and maybe this isn't a fair question to ask you, but I'm trying to juggle with the shortcomings that are within the OIA system, and really our ability to maintain the integrity of a system that seems to work and there's a lot of buy-in for. Now, we have a lot of people come and testify for the crime prevention grants, and everyone wants everything, but that's a kind of more new agey new kind of model that we passed really last session in what, Senate Bill 555? 99, Senate Bill 555, but really money was really available last session more so than in, is that right? 99.
There was some funding, Mr. Chair, in 99-01, and it rolled up to a full biennium's funding. So they had part of a program during the 99-01 budget and a full program during 01-03.
Without Craig behind me, since you asked the question, I think the diversionary funds are an old, much older set of funds. So the recognition was there early on of the need to help the counties divert kids who could properly be diverted. They don't have that pot of money does not have nearly the accountability as the crime prevention funds, and the appeal for the crime prevention funds, I think, is that there's a lot of accountability on it, although there's been a tendency to want to push those funds to earlier kinds of prevention to younger kids. My personal opinion would be that some of those high-risk funds and the diversion funds could come together, still addressing the high-risk kids that are most likely to come into the youth authority if they are not specifically targeted at the kids most likely to commit crimes that will lead to commitment to the state.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Well, the dilemma that we always have is because we didn't spend the prevention dollars a decade ago, we're dealing with the kids that we didn't prevent from getting into the programs that are needed. There's no question, strategically, those will pay off. But there's always one block of time when you really need to be doing both. And if you don't spend the prevention money now, we'll pay more later. By the same token, it's still necessary to keep the dollars for containing the kids that didn't benefit from prevention programs a few years back. But the other dilemma that we have is, even with diversion, if we're saying that we're dealing with 600 beds instead of 1,000 beds, and we're trying to keep everything in balance, we spend less money on diversion because we're trying to get it diverting away from the 600 bed total instead of the 1,000 bed total, and yet you've got 400 kids that probably are in need of programs more desperately because you don't have to, because you've got fewer beds. So it's hard to deal with doing things proportionately when the same need is always seems to be there.
And I would agree with you that the same need is there, but my question is, we've rolled the Oregon Youth Authority back to level, what year levels?
About 95.
1995 levels. We never had the prevention money before. We seem to be doing an okay job, and we've rolled it back to 1995 levels. And my concern is, there's also how much is enough in order for a program to be effective. If we continue to squeeze down the crime prevention grants, at what point in time does the effectiveness of the amount of dollars, there's got to be some minimal funding level for the dollars to be effective. So I guess that's what I struggle, and there's probably not a logical and clear answer to that. I guess that's what I struggle with, and it's a gut level kind of thing. So that's what, if you want to know what's inside my strange and twisted brain, that's
unfortunately, we're the legislature, so,
so we're logic, to have
logical and clear. Don't have to enter into
strange
our
strange and twisted brains are okay. All right. Enough for me. Any other members of the committee? Thank you all for coming today. We're going to start out tomorrow with a brief presentation based upon the questions raised by Representative Butler and I, and then we will have public testimony. How many people do you anticipate tomorrow, Karen? Do you have any idea?
I don't have any idea, Mr. Chair. I would say a room full.
Okay. Always a room full. All right. At this point in time, then, we're going to carry over House Bill 5058 until Wednesday, April 16th, 2003, for our 1 o'clock hearing. Close the hearing, and our committee is adjourned.